Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about compliance with the Constitution. Every one of our petitions drives every county demanding that they create constitutional compliance committees, because once we're focused on understanding the Constitution and obtaining compliance to it, it puts us heading and orientated to the right path in getting this government back onto the tracks that was designed for it to operate and function on. So anyway, we want to make sure that we overwhelm Gerald Winstrand on his campaign with all the different type of support you're giving him. So I want to continue harassing and basically haranguing those who are, listening, please, begging, actually, more beseeching and begging to support his campaign. He needs the financial support. He is a outlier, and folks, even if he doesn't make it, and there's no reason why he can't make it, because right now he's campaigning against and he's going around telling in his campaign process, he's letting everybody know that he's the real Republican. That way people can start understanding that sometimes when you're voting Republican, even in Missouri, you're voting for a rhino. And that's one of the reasons why the incumbent who is seeking re-election is not out campaigning. He's just sending a flunky to debate with Gerald. So, folks, get him some support, because at this point in time, they don't want to expose this guy, because I just don't think the guy has the depth to run a really challenging campaign. Anyway, with that, welcome back, Sean. And, folks, I'll just let you know that we may not have Tammy with us for a while, because she's just going through, I wouldn't say hardships, but there's been some events and so forth that has forced her to kind of realign and helping family and those types of things. And more importantly, she has responsibilities and duties with the party. So I'm still working with her, but the luxury of being able to take time to do this, the show, reading and so forth, she just does not have the available time. So she'll be back. She will be back. It's just that she's a little overwhelmed. And so last thing you want to do to anybody that's volunteering is deride them and, give them a hard time for not helping or anything like that. Shoot, I'm happy to receive any help, any blessings, anything that we can get in the cause of liberty. And so I probably don't do it enough, thanking Sean, thanking Tammy and those who help for what they do, because we need all hands on deck. We need everybody in this fight. Anyway, so with that, Sean, we just covered the moral bankruptcy point that was done by Mr. Pierce. Now, Mr. Bishop is going to kind of start talking about elections and states as bad actors, or this is going to come up in this dialogue. So, folks, we're not highlighting one particular point that's being brought up. We're actually, in this debate, they kind of make these succinct remarks back and forth. They're amongst friends, and they kind of let the hair fly, or the fur fly, however you want to call it. And so what we want to do is kind of capture the dialogue as it kind of goes through whether it ends on its own volition or they start going down rat holes. We want to kind of cover this. So we've highlighted the area of discussion that we're going to cover regarding elections, states, and bad actors. And we've done that with other topics in this debate. So let's go ahead and pick this up with the Honorable Mr. King. So, Sean, why don't we pick it back up from the next highlighted area, like I was talking about, starting off with the Honorable Mr. King. Go ahead, pick that up. Thank you.
The Honorable Mr. King rose and assured the convention that the state of Rhode Island did, by a solemn resolution, sometime since recall its delegates. The Honorable Mr. Gorham confirmed what Mr. King had said and added that during the session of the federal convention, when seven states only were represented in Congress, application was made by two companies for the purchase of lands, the sale of which would have sunk $7 or $8 million of dollars of the continental debt. And the most pressing letters were sent on to Rhode Island to send on its delegates, but that state refused. The consequence was the contract could not then be made. Mr. Bishop confessed himself convinced of the fact. He proceeded to observe that if the state shall refuse to do their duty, then let the power be given to Congress to oblige them to do it. But if they do their duty, Congress ought not to have the power to control elections. In an uncontrolled representation, says Mr. B., lies the security of freedom. And he thought by these clauses that freedom was sported with. In fact, says he, the moment we give Congress this power, the liberties of the yeomanry of this country are at an end. But he trusted they would never give it, and he felt the consolation from the reflection.
Okay, so there's a few things that really jump out of this little dialogue. First off, the Mr. King points out, because I believe Rufus King was at the convention, and he points out how Rhode Island basically did the solemn resolution to recall its delegates from Congress, because they were literally, I mean, if you understand, folks, Congress could not do things without unanimous consent. And without delegates there, they were dead. Does that make sense, Sean?
Yes, sir.
So what Rhode Island basically did was an ultimate and an absolute slap in the face. It was pure disrespect from Rhode Island to the rest of the states to say, to heck with you, we don't care. We're not going to give you anything. So now Mr. Gorham points out that, hey, you know, we had seven states that were ready to go to sell land. And who knows, this land could have been in Ohio. Who knows? And it doesn't say whether this was international investment or whether this was people within the states. But he was pointing to this concept that this was worth millions of dollars. He said $7 or $8 million. He used the millions. Interesting. But anyway, so he's basically saying, here was an opportunity to pay off some of the debt. And because Rhode Island was refusing to get involved or to do their share in, you know, in their representation in Congress to pass this stuff, it was just another, I'll just say, I'm sticking it to the Articles of Confederation, sticking it to Continental Congress to basically say, you know, you guys are dead because we have this level of control over you. And so as we kind of look at this, you know, this concept, then we can go, okay, so Rhode Island was so problematic that it wasn't just not paying their debt and sufficiently paying their debt with good currency. They were killing deals. I mean, when you really start looking, the way you can garner, you know, the current events and what had been happening, you can really see that it's far worse than even the way, you know, historians kind of cover it. I mean, I don't know of any historian that has ever pointed out these three facts, that Rhode Island basically gave them the death knell by pulling out, that they weren't there, they didn't have the unanimity required to even pass anything. They also basically killed this whole concept of the selling of this land for millions of dollars. And so this gravitates into this other point where Mr. Bishop basically says, I'm concerned if we kind of give this up. But he does basically conclude that he trusted that they would never give this up, that the states would never give this up. that the, and it's in the fourth section. The fourth section, which provides the state legislature shall prescribe the time, place, and manner of holding elections, and that Congress may at any time make or alter them. And so, as we look at that and we look historically, it really was never given up, at least until 1856. And it wasn't given up really by the states doing, it was given up by the organized factions, or I should say the organized parties that were coming to power. The Democrat and the new Republican, not the original Madison-Jefferson Republican Party, this new Republican Party, which went into league with the Democrats to say, we need to seize control so we never lose our place here again. It's, you know, this is just, it's not good for the country to ebb and flow with these parties, with the Whigs and so forth. They felt that the stability would be better if the two parties gained control. And I'm here to tell you folks, any parties controlling government is a bad thing. But since 1856, that is when they shifted a portion, or they shifted this one part of access to our government, fell under the control of parties. In other words, we're no longer a representative government where we the people are directly engaged in these processes. The party now has seized control over that. And this is one of the reasons why Gerald Winstrom's campaign is so important. He is fighting the party, as I stated earlier today. As we look at the next step when Congress overreached and got themselves into the knickers of the states, it wasn't until, I would say, the 1930s, when they had such problems in trying to get people to vote, because many of the states were looking, and it seemed like, and this becomes the indictment, folks. So what ended up happening, Congress established a national day of election on the first Tuesday of every November, or, you know, every 4 years and every 2 years for the representatives and so forth, and senators. Because one-third of the class of senators is being voted for every 2 years, and all representatives are being voted for every 2 years. But every 4 years, it's the president. So every 2 years, we have this federal election. And they basically laid it out by exercising this power, make it any time and alter them, and they established a national day of election so that the West Coast and the people, you know, somewhere in the Midwest or what have you, wouldn't feel disenfranchised, because they go, okay, you know, we don't know what the outcome is, because they didn't have real-time voting and pollsters and so forth, and it was a mystery until the next day or two to find out who really won the election back in those days. It's not like today where we find out by midnight who made president because of the direct elections and so forth. Technically, we should not find out when the president has been chosen until December time frame. We should only be choosing our electors, and then the electors go off and choose, and it really alleviates this whole concept of this direct election. But anyway, I digress. The point is that Congress at that point really did, the first time they stepped on top of that line and said, this is when elections will be. We've had such problems, and I've said this before, we have had such problems in the past with stolen elections and, you know, election fraud as well as voter fraud, that I believe Congress should actually lay out and establish that all elections, because when we went in, Sean, I know you told me, but were you involved in the election in Iraq in the early 1990s?
No, sir.
Where they, you know, the Iraqis dipped their finger in the ink to basically prove that they voted that day because it wouldn't wash off.
And no, I wasn't there, but I've seen that method used. I think they use that in Indy, parts of India as well.
Yeah. Okay, so, but the point is that we basically supported that election, and we wanted to make sure that there was no voter fraud because we couldn't trust anybody. And if you're going to conduct election...
Ironic, isn't it?
If you're going to conduct an election, you basically have to operate that you can't trust anybody. You just can't trust anybody. Because if you give anybody any latitude, they will try to figure out a way to take that control, to get to go down that path. So the point is that when we went into Iraq, we literally, you know, conducted that election not trusting anybody. And I believe we're at that point. We've only proven in the several past elections with Obama. With Obama, I've proven how election fraud actually did step in that second election with Romney. The fact is, and I don't know who that is, because that's just going to ring, folks. I don't care. What matters is that Congress can actually alleviate all of these automatic, because the first election that was really problematic, that was proven problematic, was the Obama second term election, where there were so many overvotes in that. In other words, there were more overvotes for Obama. We're talking millions of overvotes that gave him that election. I don't want to go down the path of doing that. If you want to, someday I'll go down on how we figured this out. But the fact is this, is that we can't trust these elections anymore. And the only kind of election that we can trust is a paper, hard validated, you dip your thumb, you dip your finger in the ink, or what have you, to ensure that nobody votes twice, and that it is not something that can be stolen via algorithms, via software, or anything else. And Congress also needs to make a law that basically says any person that is caught with ballots in their possession after all ballots should have been surrendered and turned in will be a federal felony. You can't make it a federal offense because it's got to require an amendment. So it would be a federal state offense that person, at a minimum on the federal side, would lose their citizenship. You want to screw around with our elections? Now you'll never be able to vote. Now you'll never be able to participate in this great experiment we call, you know, America. And the states would actually have to, you know, throw the book at them using a felony, what have you, incarcerating them, because that's just one thing that can't be acceptable. As a matter of fact, I think the framers probably would have handed out a capital offense. In other words, death by hanging. You know, you will be hanged. Anywho, we talked about this, and I wanted to kind of reconnect this. We did talk about how the 17th Amendment was passed in 1913 because there were all of these election problems, and how the states were very frustrated because people were becoming less diligent in doing their voting because of, you know, the time differences between East Coast, West Coast, for whatever these different reasons have been. It got so bad by the 1930s that Congress just finally said, okay, because apparently the 17th Amendment didn't fix the problem, if you know what I mean. Because remember, we talked about that.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm hoping that as we, you know, when we look at things from the real macro view, we can kind of see how, you know, we have been suffering at our own hand. And I mentioned this, and I probably marginalized or didn't follow up on. When Congress established the first Tuesday of November to be the election day in the 1930s or 40s, whenever that was, when they did that, to me, that was a reaction to an indictment of our society, that the Americans only cared about directly voting for their president, for their king, then understanding the importance of voting for their representatives and voting for, you know, the local issues, from the local representatives, local issues, to the congressional representatives. Folks, because we shifted our only concern to only the president, this is a huge indictment. It actually goes to show how we became more and more disinterested. So what they tried to do was they tried to make it, I'll call it, Vegas interesting. Oh, now we don't know what's happening. But that went out the window, too, by the 60s and the 70s. As global communication started improving, we started finding how, again, I don't know if you knew this, but in the late 60s and the early 70s, because of global communication, they started noticing the polls. People stopped showing up at polls later on in the day when they started getting close to calling the election on the West Coast and beyond. So I'm not sure if you remember those things, but
me
living on the West Coast, we still were eating that bitter pill that because they could actually call that, it was affecting the elections. And the people that chose not to go, they missed their opportunity of choosing their representative, which is the most important votes that they will cast that day. Because they're the sovereigns. They're the ones that can alleviate our problems. Getting good representatives in, especially those who are going to be compliant to the Constitution, so forth and so on. So hopefully this all makes sense. Wow, just in those three paragraphs, or just in those three comments, boom, we got all of that. Now, Mr. Strong makes this comment regarding the election, the election attendance, and so forth, as we were just talking about. So let's go ahead and dive into what Mr. Strong says. Thank you so much.
The Honorable Mr. Strong followed Mr. Bishop and pointed out the necessity there is for the fourth section. The power, says he, to regulate the elections of our federal representatives must be lodged somewhere. I know of but two bodies wherein it can be lodged, the legislatures of the several states and the General Congress. If the legislative bodies of the states, who must be supposed to know at what time and in what place and manner the elections can best be held, should so appoint them, it cannot be supposed that Congress, by the power granted by this section, will alter them. But if the legislature of a state should refuse to make such regulations, the consequence will be that the representatives will not be chosen and the general government will be dissolved. In such case, can gentlemen say that a power to remedy the evil is not necessary to be lodged somewhere? And where can it be lodged but in Congress? I will consider its advantage in another respect. We know, sir, that a negligence in the appointment of rulers is the characteristic of all nations. In this state, and since the establishment of our present Constitution, the first officers of government have been elected by less than 1/10 part of the electors of the state. We also know that our town meetings for the choice of officers are generally attended by an inconsiderable part of the qualified voters. People attend so much to their private interests that they are apt to neglect this right. Nations have lost their liberties by neglecting their privileges. Consequently, Congress ought to have an interposing power to awaken the people when thus negligent. Even supposing, sir, the provisional clause suggested by the worthy gentleman from Norton should be added, would not Congress then be the judges whether the elections in the several states were constitutional and proper? If so, it would then stand on the same ground it now does. It appears evident that there must be a general power to regulate general elections. Gentlemen have said that the proposed Constitution was in some places ambiguous. I wish they would point out the particular instances of ambiguity. For my part, I think the whole of it is expressed in the plain, common language of mankind. If any parts are not so explicit as they could be, it cannot be attributed to any design. For I believe a great majority of the men who formed it were sincere and honest men.
Okay, so now we're basically, you know, we're going to be going into break in just a second here. And so what we kind of want to do is, you know, kind of have to come back and pick this up from when we come back. But, I mean, any real things you want to garner on this or chew on?
No, sir.
Okay. Then I'll bring some of these points up because, I mean, very prophetic. He's talking about here. Again, folks, we're going to be right back after this, and we will continue this discussion. Again, I mean, we haven't hit the holy rollers part yet, where they start talking about, you know, how important this is, or even Massachusetts' indifference. We'll be right back.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so he points out here, Mr. Strong, that he, you know, lays it out that the states will do this, but if the states fail to, it needs to be handed to somebody, and who should it be? it obviously should go to the federal legislature. And so that's why he kind of supports this, that it, and ensures that this is to be done. It was hard for them, at least some of these men, it was hard for them to fathom why the representatives of the states would want to meddle in the state affairs. It would have caused reproach. It would have caused a good chance of being, you know, voted out in their reelection bid if they wanted to stay in office. So, you know, the states still had this power. It's not like this government that was being created was consolidating all power. Secondly, the other point that he brings out is that looking in the middle of this, he says the first officers of government in Massachusetts have been elected by less than one-tenth of the part of electors of the state. Now, I don't know about you, but Sean, have you ever heard where that type of voter turnout was so dismal in America?
No. I thought ours was bad. That's just pathetic.
That is inexcusably pathetic. So,
but I can understand at some level because of the times, because the people had work to do. They were working to survive every day and just, you know, from trying to build the land and farm and whatever they had. They didn't have time to be bothered with all that.
And I can add on to that. Everybody knew where everybody lived. Everybody knew, you know, whether these people were trustworthy or not because they knew what you did. I mean, they saw how you acted and it got around. I mean, this is long before the days when everybody knew who had the fastest car or the, you know, fastest girl, what have you, right? This is when they really knew, you know, the difference in, you know, the character of these individuals in their communities and so forth. And it was common knowledge because it wasn't like, you know, a sea of millions and millions of people. Shoot, Massachusetts was it was less than 500,000, if I remember correctly, as far as population throughout Massachusetts. So, again, these were the days where they knew where, you know, you broke your bread every night with your family. And so, you know, you always want to do the honorable thing because the last thing you wanted to do is get people pissed off showing up at your house in the middle of the night with, you know, torches and, you know, pitchforks and tar and feathers and a rail or a rod. So, yeah, these were different times. And he also pointed out the historical view that nations have lost their liberties by neglecting their privileges. Consequently, Congress ought to have an interposing power. In other words, when the states want to become indifferent, because he points out that this is one way that the states could literally, you know, create an insolvent federal government if they weren't electing their representatives, so nobody would show up. They wouldn't be able to pass laws. They wouldn't be able to, you know, the taxation, spending, government would come to literally a standstill. And so one of the things that kind of jumped out at me in this interposing power would have been this duty to say, you know, if you don't vote, you know, in three elections in a row, then you lose your citizenship. You know, there's no point in you being a citizen. Therefore, you know, it incentivizes people. Because if you're no longer a citizen and we're actually following the laws of the land, you lose your citizenship, you lose your protection of due process, you lose your protection of petitioning for the redress of grievances, you know, your right to be secure in your persons. All of these things that are afforded U.S. citizens would go away. So I would think that would be a big incentive to make sure that you went out and voted. You know, you may not every election, but you don't want to skip three. What do you think?
I agree. And I mean, there are some regulations in place now. I know in my state, if you're not active, then they'll put your registration on hold. And, and you could lose your voter registration if you don't vote on a certain regularity. How much do you think, was it talking about the times back then again, how much do you think it was the people just weren't used to participating in government because they were under the king and a different form of government where they weren't, they were ruled upon instead of being self-governing. So how much do you think that had to do with the turnout?
Well, you know, I think there were some factors because each state was a little different. And some states had a poll tax. Most states functioned by a poll tax. If you wanted to elect, there was this tax. And in the cheaper states or the states that were more impoverished because there was less money, less species to go around, where people were doing more bartering just to get by because they just didn't have a lot of gold. And we're going to talk about paper money and gold and silver, you know, in these debates. And that actually happens to be the next topic. But you got to remember that, you know, do you go spend the last of your species just to participate in an election when you still, you know, mama needs some new shoes or baby needs some diapers, what have you, right? You've got these real financial needs, and participating in government may be one of the least of your concerns at that point in time. And I think in Massachusetts, everybody were free landholders, everybody. They all own their land, and I believe that if they had a poll tax, that would have been a real, because the Shea Rebellion was just came up, right? What was it, 1785, 84, 85, I think was the Shea Rebellion, where in Massachusetts, the citizens just couldn't bear the taxation that the state was putting on them. And they kind of stood up in revolt and said, hey, you know, we got to feed ourselves here too. You know, we have to come first. So anyway, I think that there was a lot of different factors. There were. And they didn't see the end of the world when they knew that the current John Hancock was, you know, going to be either reelected or stepping down, and Samuel Adams was going to step in. I mean, they had that kind of environment where they really just had really good, honorable people to vote for. So why? I could see the circumstances of the time. But today, because we have so many problems and because there are so many people in a congressional district, we're almost at 1 million, you can't afford not to vote for your representative. Nobody in their congressional districts can afford not to vote, if that makes sense. So anyway.
Oh, it makes sense, because the people who have an agenda that more than likely does not match with your values, they're going to vote. And they're digging up people out the cemetery to vote.
Yes. So let's jump down into the paper money with Mr. Turner. And let's take it from there. And as, I don't know if you noticed, but at the beginning of, so this is on Thursday, January 17th, folks. And if you look right underneath the date, it says the fourth section still under deliberation. So Massachusetts chose to go through the Constitution line by line. And they were one of the few states that successfully actually did it. There were points in time where they were being tugged and pulled by the anti-federalists to jump to something, you know, forward, or to go back to something that they wanted to make hay on. But for the most part, they had a pretty decent discipline. But if, you know, John Hancock was the president of the convention, and Samuel Adams was there as a part of this. And these men were not the type that believed in, you know, in discourse, in something so important as, you know, maintaining civility in examining this new presented government. There was a lot of respect, you know, offered by these men in looking and examining this, and we'll actually get to that a little bit later. But let's go ahead and dive into the paper money part. Go ahead.
Mr. Turner is speaking. It gives me pain, and I believe it gives pain to others, thus to characterize the country in which I was born. I will endeavor to guard against any injurious reflections against my fellow citizens, but they must have their true characters, and if I represent them wrong, I'm willing to make concessions. I think that the operation of paper money and the practice of privateering have produced a gradual decay of morals, introduced pride, ambition, envy, lust of power, produced the decay of patriotism and the love of commutative justice. And I am apprehensive these are the invariable concomitants of the luxury in which we are unblessedly involved, almost to our total destruction. In the lower ranks of people, luxury and avarice operate to the want of public duty and the payment of debts. These demonstrate the necessity of an energetic government. As people become more luxurious, they become more incapacitated for governing themselves. And are we not so? Alike people, alike prince.
Okay.
Very prophetic.
Yes. And so
that's the bottom line today.
These men saw this. These men knew where they were in their time. And so as we look at this point in time, that because they're looking at history, they saw that this was the standard indictment of society's past. So this pride, ambition, lust for power, avarice, and so forth, yeah, absolutely, especially in the lower ranks. The point I think that they're really making here, and they haven't really dove into it, is that, you know, when you're given a situation where you are having, you know, this problem where it was stated in the Pennsylvania debates regarding money, and the loss of its value was literally losing property. You don't have to be a genius, folks, to realize that when you take a dollar bill today, you know, you can't buy a candy bar. You cannot buy a candy bar. I remember as a kid, Grandma would give us a nickel. We'd all get to go pick what candy we wanted from the store. A nickel. And we're talking about, I mean, big portion candy. We'd walk, you know, shoot, maybe I was 5 years old. I had an older brother and older sister that I walked with. And we went down to the nearest store several blocks away, and we walked back. And it was just, you know, it was a great experience of the summertime for me, but you can't do that today. As a matter of fact, I look at the 50 as a $10 bill of the past. That's how far our currency has devalued. And that means that our property, we're making it, it's making harder and harder for us to acquire property, to keep property, and so forth. I can't imagine, and I just know, that there's way too many people that are struggling and in pain, financial pain in America. And I say that because the statistics out there prove that we're less than probably, I think by now, 10% of America has any type of savings. I mean, not a substantial savings, any type of savings that can give them relief if a hard time bestows upon them for a paycheck. In other words, you know, something happens where they can't use that paycheck. Something happens, they've got to have extra money. They just don't have a source to do that. So what do? They put it on a credit card. And there's so many people that are living with rollover credit that, I mean, they are in a financial storm that is all being created by the government. Now, in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, he pointed out, who is the criminal? Is it the person that's struggling because of what government is doing to their currency by taxation and so forth? Whatever it is, government is driving this economic train. And who do you blame? Is the person the criminal that goes out and evades taxes? Is the person the criminal because, you know, they have to do backdoor deals or what have you, going into the black market just to buy something that's not regulated? So the question is, folks, who's the criminal? Is it the individual that is struggling, that has to do everything they can to survive, or is it government? And in America, it's hands down, it's government. Because the things that government is doing, they don't have the authority to do. The Constitution demands that we have a gold and silver currency, and the Congress regulate the value thereof to ensure that we have a stable economy and a stable currency. They're not doing their job. Let's go to the next one where we talk about representation and taxation. It's just a little further down. Thank you.
Mr. King rose to explain it. There has, says he, been much misconception of this section. It is a principle of this Constitution that representation and taxation should go hand in hand. This paragraph states that the number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed 3/5 of all other persons, these persons are the slaves. By this rule, are representation and taxation to be apportioned, and it was adopted because it was the language of all America. According to the Confederation, ratified in 1781, the sums for the general welfare and defense should be apportioned according to the surveyed lands and improvements thereon in the several states. But that it hath never been in the power of Congress to follow that rule, the returns from the several states being so very imperfect.
This is where he's kind of laying out and again pointing out that the 3/5, the persons are the slaves. These persons are the slaves. And just making sure that everybody understands why that was done that way. Because, again, everybody's going, well, what is this? What is this 3/4, 3/5, you know, rule? What does that mean? Anyway, going down a little bit further, they actually, because this kind of started this long conversation. And so when we go down to Friday, January 8th, there's this dialogue by Dawes, regarding the slaves. Go ahead. As you can tell, folks, I'm just highlighting just small portions of this. Go ahead.
Mr. Dawes, he thought, however, that gentlemen would do well to connect the passage in dispute with another article in the Constitution that permits Congress in the year 1808 wholly to prohibit the importation of slaves, and in the meantime to impose a duty of $10 a head on such blacks as should be imported before that period. Besides, by the new Constitution, every particular state is left to its own option totally to prohibit the introduction of slaves into its own territories. What could the convention do more? The members of the southern states, like ourselves, have their prejudices. It would not do to abolish slavery by an act of Congress in a moment and so destroy what our southern brethren consider as property. But we may say that, although slavery is not smitten by an apoplexy, yet it has received a mortal wound and will die of a consumption.
Ah, so the hinting of the end of slavery based on what they put in place kind of lays out here. I think somebody else may say in no uncertain terms that this is going to end slavery in America. Now, let me go into, because here is a hard definition for a clause in Article 1, Section 9. And it is subsection 1 that states, the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. And right here he says that he thought, however, that the gentleman would do well to connect the passage to dispute with another article, which is basically what I just read, in the Constitution that permits Congress in the year 1808 wholly to prohibit the importation of slaves. Is there any question as to what that clause means now?
No, sir.
When people look at this and say, well, this means that they can start regulating the migration of people. No. This only means that they, and I'll read it again, shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to So in other words, the importation of slaves shall not be prohibited by Congress. It doesn't say that Congress will now have full control and cognizance over all immigration. They only have the ability to prohibit state immigration or the state migration of slaves. And that is why this clause right here helps everybody understand that this line in Article 1, Section 9 is not empowering the federal government to regulate migration, immigration, those things. They don't have that in their power. It's not in Article 1, Section 8. That's where the listed powers are. The only power that they have there regarding the migration of persons is that they have the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. So in other words, they set the standards of what it takes to become a U.S. citizen. That's it. Again, this is where when we go through this, how they stipulate, how they clarify these clauses, it just lays out, you know, any type of misinterpretation by the judges and how they've reread this and redefined these things, and they've avoided these ratification debates like that it's a plague because they knew it would stop them from being able to move forward, because as soon as they started citing the ratification debates, everybody else would pick them up and find out, hey, you're citing the anti-federalists. That's not how the Constitution was sold. And the truth would come out. So we go down now. We're kind of progressing, right? And so we're going down to Monday, the 21st, and Judge Dana basically starts talking about corporations. Go ahead.
This section, Mr. President, has been subject to much dispute and difficulty. I did not come here approving of every paragraph of this Constitution. I suppose this clause is dangerous. It has been amply discussed, and I am now convinced that this paragraph is much better as it stands than with the amendment, which is that Congress be restricted in the appointing of time and place, etc., unless when the state legislature refused to make them. I have altered my opinion on this point. These are my reasons. It is apparent the intention of the convention was to set Congress on a different ground, that a part should proceed directly from the people and not from their substitutes, the legislatures. Therefore, the legislature ought not to control the elections. The legislature of Rhode Island has lately formed a plan to alter their representation to corporations, which ought to be by numbers. Look at Great Britain, where the injustice of this mode is apparent. 8/10 of the people there have no voice in the elections. A borough of but 2 or 3 cottages has the right to send 2 representatives to Parliament, while Birmingham, a large and populous manufacturing town lately sprung up, cannot send 1. The legislature of Rhode Island are about adopting this plan in order to deprive the towns of Newport and Providence of their weight, and that thereby the legislature may have a power to counteract the will of a majority of the people.
So interestingly enough, Rhode Island went down the path of starting to create corporations. Now, we see in government, in America, how actually, and we've proven, Madison has pointed out, and we actually found it in the articles or the notes on the convention, where the idea of corporations came forward, and they rejected it. Madison reiterated that in the debates in Congress, that they rejected the idea that Congress would have the ability to create corporations. Now, it didn't mean the states couldn't. But understanding today how corporations were the vehicle of corrupting our government, are you surprised, Sean, that it was first played in Rhode Island?
Yeah, I thought it would have been Delaware.
Oh, because of their openness of the corporations, right, and all that. Yeah, that's all for tax shelters. You do know that. I mean, Delaware was...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, but what Rhode Island was doing, because it says right there that they were basically playing this game to counteract the will of a majority of the people. They were fighting a democracy by using corporations instead of using the U.S. Constitution and creating a supermajority, because you know what? When you're standing in the middle of a, you know, a large group of independently minded, not two gangs, but a group of independently minded people that have different ties and affiliations with each other. Obviously, that's a society. You know, when you have two gangs, it's, you have two diametrically opposed groups. But in society, you have all these people with these common interests and conflicting interests with, you know, the same people and so forth. But the point is that what they were doing was trying to get away from a simple majority. What they should have done, and this is what every state needs to do, is they need to change the ratification process of an amendment or even a new constitution, that it would, excuse me, require minimum two-thirds, if not three-fourths of the counties to ratify a new state constitution. That it would take two-thirds or three-fourths of the states to ratify an amendment to the Constitution, removing the ability of a mob rule and basically a population center to seize control of the government, which is plaguing us today. Every state is being plagued by this. So anyway, let's dive down a little bit further. The use of corporations, because they talk a little bit more about this.
The Honorable Mr. King rose to pursue the inquiry why the, quote, place and manner.
Oh, Sean, I forgive me. I just realized that we're that close to running out of time. What I'd like to do is I'd like to find out what you might have as far as go backs and so forth. I mean, is there anything that you'd like to bring up that might, you know, that we can kind of cover at what we have left as far as time goes? What do you think? You got anything?
Cause I have nothing, sir. Really?
Really? Really? You're just going to leave me hanging? I've taken this a little time to... All right, folks. I've provided witness that, you know, Sean does have a lot of great ideas, but he's a man of few words. If it's not a great idea, he's going to keep it to himself. All that being said, the importance, what I'm trying to point out with these, because these debates bring up all these different topics, folks. One of those topics, one of the very few times we're going to read about corporations, is in Massachusetts. We're also going to read some other things in Massachusetts that talks about how Congress cannot make a law and immune themselves from that law. So what we want to do is we want to really go down this, you know, this path in these ratification debates to give you where you can find these different topics, because even if the topic or the assertion is not made in every state debate, if it's made in one state, such as Congress cannot pass laws to immune themselves, that applies to all. What that means, folks, because of the uniformity, all Congress has to basically, and all of the federal government has to uniformly act when they're acting with their states. So when somebody actually points out and states the obvious that, hey, they don't have the power to create a law and immune themselves, remember, that would have to be delegated for them to do that. It's the same thing as delegating them a retirement and those types of things. They can't do that either. So Massachusetts really highlights these very important points. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process,
process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.